May it please the Court. Your Honors, although two issues are here presented similar to the last case, I'm here primarily to ask this Court to resolve the legal question of what constitutes a Fourth Amendment seizure by submission to a show of law enforcement authority. The specific question before this Court in point one of this case is whether Mr. Perry was seized as a matter of law under the Fourth Amendment when Officer Huber accosted him in his fiancée's driveway and he submitted to her demand for, and she retained, his driver's license. Upon review of the totality of facts and circumstances in this case, this Court should find that Mr. Perry did submit to Officer Huber's show of authority. The seizure was unreasonable and offensive to the Fourth Amendment. And accordingly, the trial court clearly erred in overruling Mr. Perry's motion to suppress methamphetamine evidence seized as fruit of this illegal seizure. The first part of this analysis requires the undertaking of whether there was a show of authority by Officer Huber in this case, and I think under the facts it's clear. The Supreme Court of the United States in Mendenhall and Royer made clear that the determination of whether there has been an official show of authority by an officer must be viewed through the prism of a reasonable, objective person under the totality of facts and circumstances. Mendenhall thus requires a holistic assessment of the coercive effect of police conduct. In this way, the show of authority analysis is fact-intensive and unique to each case. Here, the facts from the suppression hearing at trial are, including those in Huber's dash cam video, Exhibit 1, which I would encourage the Court to view, describing what occurred on October 24, 2013. Huber testified that she had been building a case on Mr. Perry for more than 2 years. She believed him to be involved with methamphetamine sales. Officer Huber and Mr. Perry had a history. She had arrested Mr. Perry approximately 6 months prior. His license was not suspended at that time. No charges were filed as a result of this arrest. She knew Mr. Perry's house and vehicle. He was a marked man. She drove by Mr. Perry's house as part of her patrol, and she saw his blue GMC truck leave. The truck plates came back registered to Mr. Perry. Officer Huber tailed Mr. Perry's truck for upwards of 4 minutes through the Chillicothe streets, numerous turns, including sort of a circle route, and she continued to tail Mr. Perry through a stop that he made and his release of a passenger. She testified that she was in fact hunting him. She was waiting for him to commit any infraction, failure to signal, incomplete stop. She followed Mr. Perry to his initial endpoint, which was his fiance's residence, Ms. Angela Stock. Officer Huber stopped in the street when Mr. Perry stopped. This was a two-lane street. She more or less blocked a lane of traffic in the street, very nearly obstructing the driveway, which can be clearly seen from the Exhibit 1 dash cam video. Also from the Exhibit 1 dash cam video can be seen that she immediately jumped out of her patrol vehicle when Mr. Perry exited his. She was donning her uniform, her badge, and her service weapon. She immediately went up to Mr. Perry and said, "Hey Joe, can I talk to you?" as she rushed to him. He agreed, stopped what he was doing at that moment. Then she immediately said, "Do you have a valid driver's license? I believe you're suspended." Mr. Perry said he was not suspended, but as Officer Huber walked toward Mr. Perry, she asked for his license. Mr. Perry produced his license and he handed it over to Officer Huber. Officer Huber retained his license while attempting to radio dispatch. The collective force of Huber's conduct was sufficiently coercive that an objective, reasonable person was not free to ignore her request to speak with her. A reasonable person would not feel free to leave under these circumstances. More importantly, in the context of her dogged pursuit of Mr. Perry, ending with her springing out of her patrol vehicle to accost him on private property, no less, Officer Huber's use of accusatory language to articulate she believed him suspended indicated to Mr. Perry that compliance with her request was mandatory. Such inquisitorial statements are not present in the vast run of consensual encounters between police and individuals, and they certainly make any encounter more coercive. The next step of the analysis is whether Mr. Perry submitted to Officer Huber's clear show of authority.
But their evidence showed that Officer Huber wasn't yelling at Mr. Perry. It was more of a conversational tone. Isn't that true?
It's true that there was no indication of tone of voice in the record. I think that the statement, "I believe you're suspended," question mark, and there is a question mark in the transcript, implies that there was more, that it is was a certainly a loaded question, and I think the implication is that this is not the kind of statement that would cause a reasonable person to feel that they were free to leave in that situation. It's an accusation.
But it might depend upon, you know, the inflection of the voice, you know, the mannerism and how the question was asked on how the how Mr. Perry or anybody else in that situation might have felt.
That is true, but I think in this case the content of the question is more important than the tone. And I think the content, the message of it delivered was that she clearly believed that his license was suspended, which is a crime. She accused him of a crime.
So if we're trying to think of how to, if we were to adopt your viewpoint, what would the test be if when you ask for a license because you believe a crime is, we say, you got some drugs on you, don't you? Or let me see that, or how do we apply this in the future?
Well, I think it would be the same way that this court has applied it in the same way for many years, and that's through the totality of circumstances analysis under the facts and circumstances of each case. I think in not every case it would be the same way. I think that, you know, under different facts, that same question would not be as coercive. But I think that's why, again, the sort of Mendenhall lawyer test that this court has adopted for many years, showing what a reasonable person would believe under that circumstance, would control.
And is that something we defer to the trial court on, or is that something we review de novo?
I believe that's a de novo question because it deals with a Fourth Amendment issue.
And it's objective. It's not what they think they intended, the two people involved.
It's what an objective, reasonable person would have perceived it to be in that instance. In the next step of the analysis, the court needs to look at whether Mr. Perry submitted to the show of authority. In California versus Hodari D, the Supreme Court was asked to decide whether, with respect to a show of authority, as with respect to application of physical force, a seizure occurs, even though the subject does not yield. And the court there held that it does not. In so holding, the Supreme Court applied to the Fourth Amendment context a common law arrest rubric to state that seizure requires either physical force or, where that is absent, submission to the assertion of authority. Thus, under Hodari, Mr. Perry could only be seized if he submitted to Officer Huber's show of authority. Again, the facts here are very clear. As previously explained, the totality of circumstances confirm that Officer Huber made a show of authority when she hunted Mr. Perry around Chillicothe and jumped out of her patrol vehicle to accost him in Ms. Stock's driveway with a request for his driver's license, coupled with the accusation that his license was suspended. In direct response to the show of authority, Mr. Perry stopped what he was doing and yielded his license to Officer Huber. He did so at her behest, but did so voluntarily. By any reading of the record, his flight later on took place anywhere from many seconds to well over 1 minute after he had ceded to her request for his license. Because a person may not be detained even momentarily without reasonable objective reasons for doing so, Mr. Perry's more than momentary submission to Officer Huber's show of authority was a seizure within the meaning of Hodari and the Fourth Amendment.
Does the dash cam demonstrate the time lapse between the initial stop and his flight?
It does to a degree. We see Mr. Perry run across the screen at a later point. The exact moment that his flight began is not portrayed on the screen.
But it was about a minute 40, a minute 35 between when he first asked for the license and then when you can see him running on the dash cam.
That's correct.
That. But it would have been less time than that to when he started moving around and not submitting.
Probably so. There was testimony that on the average, the time it takes for calling to dispatch to confirm a license was about a minute. But this clearly took longer because of other circumstances with the radio being faulty and so forth. But I think that definitely there was a definite yielding there, a stoppage, which is important in this case.
Huber's retention. Your claim one question that you all disagree on is whether there was an initial seizure, whether there was an initial submission to authority. The second question is, or is there a second question as to how long his license was kept and as to whether that seizure continued because he would have felt not free to leave? And does that depend in some part on how long this period was and whether it was an unreasonable period to hold the license, even if initially it wasn't a seizure?
Absolutely. Her retention of his license is not insignificant. I think the case law makes clear that without his ID card or her ID card, a reasonable person is much less likely to believe he can simply terminate a police encounter. Obviously, since Mr. Perry's license doubled as a state-issued token of his driving privilege, he could not merely drive away from this encounter in the driveway. And accordingly, her retention of Mr. Perry's license operated to prolong the detention and ensure that his act of giving it to her was a true submission. He was stuck, in a sense. And I think this is yet further proof that Officer Huber's uncommunicated subjective belief that Mr. Perry was free to leave when she accosted him is immaterial. It doesn't matter in this case. So just because she felt that he was free to leave at that point in time doesn't mean a reasonable objective person in that circumstance would feel as much.
As you point out, free to leave without his license.
Exactly, which would be ill-advised, I think, at this point. Very quickly, before I run out of time, I do want to mention that there were a couple issues mentioned in the state's brief, including the notion of abandonment. I think this court should look to its prior holding in the Grayson opinion, particularly footnote 7. And I think that footnote is a holding that states that the law is well settled that abandonment will not be found only when incriminating evidence has been abandoned voluntarily. And that abandonment is not voluntary if it results from an illegal seizure. And I'll reserve the rest of my argument for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Appellant fled from Officer Huber, ran down a sidewalk alongside a fence while clutching a plastic bag of methamphetamine that he was pulling from his pocket at the time he was encountering Officer Huber. He then momentarily stopped and hid the bag in the top of a fence post before turning himself into the sheriff. This methamphetamine was seized after the appellant had abandoned it by hiding it in the fence. Obviously, no expectation of privacy in this fence, and appellant does not challenge that. Here, there was an intervening circumstance separating appellant's actions, his encounter with Officer Huber, wherein he was not seized and he, in fact, refused to submit to any show of authority. As we argued in our brief, since he had abandoned this methamphetamine in a place where he had no expectation of privacy, he lacked the standing to challenge the admission.
But, of course, that depends on if he was validly seized and if it's fruit of the poisonous tree.
And regarding that, Your Honor, I think the Hozier case, this case that this court decided 2 years ago, is telling. And obviously the state is not conceding that there was a seizure. We argued it was a consensual encounter. In the Hozier case, the defendant was fleeing Missouri, and the authorities in Missouri had obtained a ping order for his cell phone location. They determined he was traveling to Oklahoma and gave a warrant and a wanted bulletin, if you will, over the radio to authorities in Oklahoma. Upon hearing that, authorities in Oklahoma activated their emergency signals and gave chase to appellant, who engaged in a chase before he was eventually arrested. This court held that under the Hodari, and holding that Hodari applied in Missouri, that the flight of the appellant was an intervening circumstance, one of the prongs of testing whether or not we look at whether there's any attenuation between the nature of the stop and the seizure of the items that are sought to be suppressed.
Well, there has to be an ending point. That's very different than here running and being chased by the officer versus there where they drove to a different state and it was many hours later.
Well, there was definitely an ending point. The appellant ran. He actually began acting suspiciously prior to, and as this court has obviously viewed the exhibit, prior to him actually getting...
So you're saying is there other case law you can rely on or U.S. Supreme Court cases that say flight is an intervening factor which negates the fruit of the poisonous tree analysis?
Well, in the Hozier case, in the Hozier...
I understand that case. I'm asking generally.
Well, Hodari is controlling, and... In Hodari, which actually is, again, a fact situation similar to this, wherein the officer was following a young man who was looking back, saw the officer who had not laid hands on him or showed any authority, and began to run, and before the officer overtook him, threw away the contraband. The officer actually tackled the defendant in that case, in Hodari, and... Nevertheless, the Supreme Court held that if there had been no seizure at that point, then even if it was moments before that he had abandoned the property, that property was not subject to a Fourth Amendment.
Sure, no, and I'm asking when there was already a seizure situation, so that's why, if you would address whether there's a seizure, because certainly it's very much affected by whether there was a seizure.
And we've talked about controlling cases about the nature of these type of stops regarding a consensual encounter. In Mendenhall, for example, that was a case where an airport security asked for an ID and a ticket and asked for a consent to search. The court held there was no seizure there. A case in Missouri, and many cases in Missouri, specifically State versus Stacy, was one from the Western District in 2003, where an officer, for example, saw two individuals walking. One was acting quite nervous. The officer stopped, approached both men, asked him for the ID, and determined that he had an active warrant. That there was not a reasonable suspicion in that, but it's quite clear that both in the U.S. Supreme Court and specifically in the Delgado case, the Helbo case, and I believe the Florida versus Royer, that an investigating officer is free to ask a person for an ID without implicating the Fourth Amendment. I think the nature of this encounter here, there was no imperative given by the officer, you know, hand me your ID. She did give a reason for believing that it was suspended, and he responded, sure.
So does whether or not asking for the ID and retaining it, whether that's a seizure or not, does that vary based on the facts? Are there bright lines we can apply? How do we review that? Is it a factual question or is it a legal question? Those are three questions, but related.
It's very much based on the facts, and of course we go back to Florida versus Bostwick in the U.S. Supreme Court, where you look at whether a reasonable person believed they were either not free to leave or could decline in the case with asking for a driver's license, whether they felt free to decline or terminate the encounter. There's nothing in the record that shows that the appellant was not free to do that. He did respond. The fact that he cooperated initially in a consensual encounter does not negate the consensual nature of that.
Well, what's the significance of the fact that she's holding his driver's license? Isn't it reasonable for a person not to feel free to leave if a law enforcement officer has their driver's license?
Well, the length of time is important in that regard. And again, he handed the license to her. Of course, in this case, he did, in fact, in the encounter while she held his license. But that in and of itself, since the courts have recognized that even absent reasonable suspicion or probable cause, an officer may ask for an ID, which in most cases is a driver's license, and may in fact check it or authenticate it in some manner. So the case law is clear that merely asking for an identification and examining it does not render a consensual encounter subject to Fourth Amendment analysis.
Wouldn't it become subject to it? What if they'd been there for an hour and she'd held on to it and he couldn't leave at that point?
I think under those facts, which of course are not present here, you know, that, well, and there are certain cases where even reasonable suspicion has to give way to either a termination or advancing the probable cause.
So where is that? Can you help us draw that line?
In this case, it's of course, the facts are that it was terminated through an action other than, the record shows the officer was attempting to determine whether this, in fact, was a suspended license. It was reasonable not to simply accept the word of the appellant for that. But again, her actions have to be viewed as, were they objectively reasonable? And they were. And the key is that regardless of the nature of the encounter is important, but certainly the intervening actions, as this court found, the intervening circumstance of his flight and his hiding of the contraband, the methamphetamine, are important, and Hodari certainly recognized.
But that's where there is no seizure. So if there was a seizure first, then the analysis is different.
Well, except in the case of Hozier, where, you know, in Hozier, you had a circumstance where the authorities in Oklahoma were relying on an order that was, and I believe this court found that it was a valid ping order, but there was this court analyzed it under a standard similar to Leon, I believe, and where there's a objectively reasonable conduct by an officer based on a justifiable reliance.
Let me ask you, why was it even objectively reasonable for her to believe that his license was suspended?
She did indicate that she had spoken with a fellow officer in the past couple of weeks, who had indicated to her that she believed his license was suspended.
But our cases have said that's not enough unless, if you're relying on another officer, you have to show what that other officer based their belief on.
That's true. However, and I believe this court held that in Franklin back in 1992. However, there was a dissent in Franklin where the dissent argued that there ought to be perhaps an examination of applying Leon to that. Moreover, there were cases from the U.S. Supreme Court that specifically Arizona versus Evans and Herring versus U.S., where the court found that the Fourth Amendment exclusionary rule was not served by suppressing evidence that was based or that was gathered through objectively reasonable police.
Well, and that's the test, is there reasonable suspicion? And if it's based on talk and not facts, how can it be reasonable? That's what that was why it's excluded under that test. If there were facts on which the first officer reasonably believed that, of course, then you would have reasonable suspicion.
Well,
even if it wasn't accurate, you know.
There was a belief, whether it was correct or not, there was a belief that their license was in fact suspended. There had been a recent discussion. It wasn't.
I don't want your time to go without your addressing a second issue. In this court, you're saying the trial judge was not mistaken about the range of sentence.
This is the issue about
the range of sentence. That's directly contrary to a specific concession you made in the Court of Appeals, and that's why they didn't reach it. And you said in your brief in the Court of Appeals, because appellant's sentence was imposed on an apparently mistaken belief by the court that he was subject to a minimum term of 5 years imprisonment, appellant's sentence should be reversed and this court should remand to the circuit court for resentencing. Now you said, oh, there was no confusion, was no mistake, and you shouldn't remand. I'm very concerned that the facts suddenly are different and your concession, you don't acknowledge a change in it, you just totally change facts and argument.
That's an accurate accounting, obviously, Your Honor. But the facts didn't change, but upon a review that
you didn't say that in your brief. You just took a totally contrary position to what you took in the Court of Appeals. without saying, I conceded this below, but I was mistaken because of this?
Well, understanding that once the case was transferred, that, you know, the opinion from the Court of Appeals.
The opinion was gone.
Right. And certainly we did take a different view of that.
Clearly you did.
That's correct. And we certainly stand by our belief that the record, again, as in the first case, there was a, this was plain error, where the...
What facts changed that you said the judge didn't understand the range, and now the judge does understand the range?
No facts changed. However, a review of it was certainly warranted, and revisiting the case law caused me to believe that it was not apparent from the record that the trial judge had based his sentence on any misunderstanding of the law and no manifest injustice. I think that obviously it's important to review the record clearly, and you had the court in this case at sentencing actually correct the prosecutor when the prosecutor stated what his conviction was for. He was charged with a Class B felony. The jury convicted him of a C felony. Here there's no dispute that he was found to be a prior and persistent offender. And the court took pains to point out that he had been charged with a B, yet he was convicted of a C. But nothing in the record shows that he was, in fact, sentenced under a belief by the court that the minimum sentence for a C felony, which was indeed available, was unavailable to the court. Again, referring to the earlier case that was argued, this was one that was truly in the middle. As we argue in our brief here, that the 8-year sentence was not the minimum that was available under the enhanced range if we only look at the B sentence. For example, as we tried to illustrate, if the court, if I may finish, I see my time had run out. If the court had truly believed that it was limited to the range of punishment of a B felon, yet believed that was they wanted to sentence him within the C range, they would have had available shorter sentences of 5, 6, or 7 years.
Thank you.
Respect, we'd ask the court to affirm.
Thank you.
Counsel, I know you've got a short amount of time, but I would like for you to address this Leon analysis with respect to the potential to justify a Terry stop in this situation.
Sure. Just so I'm clear, you want whether it was a reasonable suspicion?
Ideally, it would have been good to have the officer who believed the client was suspended went to testify and why that officer believed that. But could there be a situation where the officer Huber reasonably relied on that information that was provided to the officer to justify the stop without the other officer coming to testify?
Not in this case, because...
Is it possible that it could ever occur?
Oh, absolutely. But in this case, there was no corroboration at all, and there was no evidence put on at either the suppression hearing or a trial to sort of support that. I mean, the officer from whom she allegedly got this information about his license didn't testify to the source of his information. So there were many gaps, and I think the case law makes clear that...
I think perhaps the question was, could she have testified as to the basis the other officer told her about that she had for the suspicion, and would that have been sufficient, or are you saying that's hearsay, and so that would not be suspicious?
Well, I think that's hearsay, and I think...
But could it, in some circumstances, nonetheless provide the reasonable basis?
In some circumstances, but that's not the case here, because we don't have that testimony from Officer Huber in this case.
Do we know whether or not the trial court thought that was a reasonable belief?
We do not. The trial court issued its order without any explanation at all.
So what are we to do with that?
Well, I think that, again, reasonable suspicion is a question of law that this court reviews de novo. And so...
But what about whether or not the officer was acting in good faith on the belief that the license was suspended?
Well, again, I would say that that's a Fourth Amendment issue of law that this court reviewed de novo, the factual determinations and credibility determinations from the trial court.
So the trial court did not suppress the evidence.
It did not. That is correct.
So why isn't under our usual rules of review to presume that the trial court believed the uncorroborated testimony
because
of the officer that she had been told that the license was suspended?
Well, Your Honor, because there's nothing in the record to support that at all. It would be complete hearsay. And I think in this instance, it's unreasonable for any court of review to rely on this hearsay as a basis for finding that there was reasonable suspicion in this case.
You would agree, I think, that the whole debate that we had in your argument in chief about whether this was a consensual encounter and at what point did it ripen into a seizure, that all presupposes that the officer had no reasonable suspicion and had no reasonable belief in the other officer's statement that this guy had a suspended license.
That is correct.
If either of those were true, we'd never get to the other issues.
I think that's probably fair to say. And just very quickly, I would ask the court to find that the trial court clearly erred in overruling the motion to suppress and admitting the evidence and reverse Mr. Perry's conviction and sentence, and also find that the trial court plainly erred in sentencing Mr. Perry under material false belief in the possible range of punishment. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.